Real Talk Real Muslims is a podcast by two young Muslims who talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of life as a young Muslim today.
Welcome back to Real Talk Real Muslims, a podcast where we share our experiences as first-generation American Muslims and where we aim to connect with other young Muslims to let them know that they are not alone in their struggles. This is Rawan.
And this is Rand.
Today we are back with our third episode of the Taboo series. We are so excited to be discussing the important topic of mental health with our amazing guest, Dr. Nahla.
Dr. Nahla earned her undergraduate degree from Western University in Health Sciences, where she learned about the social determinants of health, igniting her passion to support and advocate for underserved communities and minorities as a healthcare professional. She completed her MD from the University of Queensland. She applied her passion for mental health advocacy and promoting equity and always took on an integrative and multidisciplinary approach to healthcare. Nahla is breaking the stigma associated with mental health in minority communities and encouraging proactively seeking the care they need in a way that is meaningful to them.
Well, thank you for being here. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. I'm very excited.
Me too. So we're just going to get right into the questions. And a lot of these are the questions that our followers on Instagram asked, and these are the questions that they really want to know about. So first, can we start and talk a little bit about the stigma surrounding mental health in our communities and why it's important to face stereotypes?
Yes, absolutely. So the mental health stigma in our communities, especially as Muslims, in the West, I'm in Canada, you guys are in the States. It's more pronounced in our communities, I believe, than in the general population, although there is still a stigma associated with talking about certain mental health issues. But the stigma in our communities is worse, definitely. I think there's a lot more taboo, which is why we're doing this in the series, but there's a lot more it's just not okay to talk about certain things in our communities, like depression, having suicidal thoughts or thoughts of harming yourself, and talking about, because anxiety I think is a little bit more prevalent, but talking about more sort of, you know, less frequent mental health issues, hallucinations, psychotic episodes, things like that, that require admission into, you know, hospitals, for example. These are things that I don't see talked about in our Muslim community, but I do think it's getting better. So I do want to be more optimistic and positive and like be on the more positive side and say like, look, it actually is getting better. And it's because people are breaking that stereotype and talking about it online, talking about it, you know, in their jobs, in their homes as well. Like, you know, my friends who are my age or my siblings who have children are much more, have much more conversations about it with their families. So I think that it's important to break those stereotypes and we're getting there, but it's still a stigma, if that answers the question.
Yeah, for sure. And like you mentioned, you know, it's getting better in, you know, communities today, but I still think that for some communities, like some tend to be like more on the conservative side and some tend to be more like open-minded and like progressive. So how can we like normalize talking about mental health struggles in our communities, especially for like communities that may be more conservative or not willing to talk about it?
Yeah. So when I first spoke to you guys the first time, I think I realized like where I'm from and where I grew up in the greater Toronto area in Canada, it is quite liberal having asked you guys some questions and like learned a little bit about your community. So probably my experience is going to be a little bit different, but how do you do that in a conservative community? I think even looking at where I'm from here in Toronto is looking at what the trajectory looked like in my own family, in my own community from the point that we first got here, you know, 22 years ago or 24 years ago, I think actually, and, you know, going forward from there, it looks like pretty much, unfortunately, parents having to learn from seeing that it doesn't fare well in your families and in your communities and in your, you know, mosques and Islamic schools to not talk about it. Unfortunately, there are consequences of that. So you end up having individuals who really struggle with their mental health and get into really bad places in their lives. And in your own families, you recognize it as well, that if you keep suppressing it, bottling it up, closing it up and not talking about it, it ends up having a lot of consequences. So I think it's learning that lesson and recognizing that if we don't create an environment where there's discussion or even just like acknowledgement, which is where we're at sometimes, like just acknowledging the existence of these issues, that we won't normalize it. So the point of normalizing it is that, and also the advocacy that people like us have to do. So I think that we have to stand up for ourselves and look at the, you know, the community that we live in, especially the individuals who are higher up or older or more senior members of our communities, and saying, look, these are important, and this is why, this is, these are the outcomes that can happen from not talking about mental health struggles in mosques, in Islamic schools and homes, and showing them the, you know, the research, the statistics on people who self-harm or suicide or, you know, any sort of unfortunate outcomes that happen from mental illness, and what that can affect you in your relationships and your job and your life, your future as a, you know, a member of society.
Yeah, for sure. I think those are all like really great and really important points. And I think a lot of it also revolves around the older generation learning from the younger generation.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, yeah, your siblings who now have children and stuff like that, they're much more willing and they're, you know, having these conversations about mental health with their children. So I think a lot of it is just kind of like the reciprocity of our relationships in our community and being willing to learn from someone who traditionally like is not viewed as, oh, you learn from people who are younger than you. But I think to develop those attitudes is really important.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Like they don't want to learn from those younger younger individuals. Like we're the ones that learn from them, and we do. But you're right. Like it is such a I don't know what the word is, but like it's just not highly regarded to learn from a younger community when in fact we're the ones that kind of are fresher in our knowledge and like much more open-minded. And yeah, it's a really good point.
Yeah, for sure. And people often say, you know, kind of continuing on with a lot of the narratives that stigmatize mental health in our Muslim communities, people often say that being depressed or having a mental illness is Allah's way of punishing us for our shortcomings, or people will say, you know, you're depressed because you don't pray enough, so just pray more and Allah will help you. So how do we kind of have those conversations with people about seeking, the importance of seeking professional help, and explaining that mental illness is not linked to being a bad Muslim or not praying enough?
Yeah, I love that question so much. There is like a really common post or like type of dialogue that people share, especially in psychiatry, that says, if you had a broken leg and you went to the hospital, and obviously everybody took you very seriously because you had a broken leg. So, you know, you were given pain medication, your broken leg was fixed, you were given a cast, you go home with specific instructions, medications, and people check on you. People come over and say, hey, do I need to clean up your house or cook you dinner or something? It is a very clear problem that you have gone through, an issue, an ailment, and now you need support. And all we have to do now is just switch the word to depression, and everything changes. It crumbles. Like nobody finds it. Nobody takes it seriously. Like you'll go to the hospital, explain your symptoms. You're clearly very depressed. And oftentimes even the response in hospitals isn't as good. And the outcome of an admission is not as good. Or, you know, the instructions after being discharged home isn't as good. Or the medication that you're provided isn't, it's just not taken as seriously in the community. And then you go home and you need that same support. You need someone to help you clean up. You need someone to help you make dinner. You need someone to help support you and, or, you know, just get you through day by day. Or you need that external support, you know, i.e. therapy or medication. Why don't we take it as seriously as a broken leg? It's an ailment. It's an ailment that is equally as debilitating. So how do we explain it to people? I think doing it that way, like respectfully saying like, hey, look, this is, it's a very debilitating ailment. It's important and it needs, we need to respect that it is important. So when it comes to religion, it's the same thing. Like if somebody was struggling with, it's really hard to explain, I guess, medical issues, but if you do get diagnosed with, unfortunately, a cancer or any sort of medical ailment, people are not going to say, you don't pray enough. Like you didn't pray enough in your life. You didn't give enough zakat. You weren't a good enough person. Therefore now you're sick. Like it's the same concept. So if you have a mental illness, whether it's depression, anxiety, eating disorder, you know, any of those types, you're not less of a good Muslim or less of a good person. You are suffering from a disease with a chemical imbalance, with a very diagnosable set of criteria, that should be taken seriously. And the cure or the treatment for all of them looks different. And a lot of the time it does include spirituality, because spirituality does give you a sense of comfort, of community, of belonging, which is really important for your mental health and well-being. So that can be part of that process and that journey for you to feel better. But you also need most likely, you probably don't always need it, but most of the time you need a therapeutic counselor, whether it's psychology, psychotherapy, or a psychiatrist. You might need medication to help you stabilize your mental health, and you might need a good, you know, a regimen, so a list of instructions on how to go about your day. So people need a lot of routine, especially with eating disorders and anxiety disorders. So you end up having like a lifestyle change, and lots of very, not just, you know, passive things that you do, but very active and intentional things that you have to do every single day to get over those ailments. So it's not about religion. It's not, you're not a weak person or a weak Muslim for being mentally ill.
I think that's really important to talk about because it is like very prevalent in our communities. And I personally heard this a lot, like in our community too, like, oh, you know, maybe you should just pray or do this or do that. So kind of going along the same lines, if a young Muslim wants to mm-hmm. seek help and they want to see a therapist, but their parents might not understand their struggles or do not approve of them going to therapy, what should they do and how can they seek help?
Yeah, that's really hard. I have to admit, like I was in therapy over the last few months during COVID, and my parents didn't really know, I guess, because it was all online. So I was on my laptop. I was able to open my laptop and, you know, join in on all of my meetings with my therapist. So it wasn't something I even discussed with them because I didn't think that it was any of their business. Like, it's just me doing my own thing, going on my, you know, I'd be like, oh, I have an appointment, and I'd go and do it. And I think that's part of my boundary with my family is I don't have to share things I don't feel comfortable sharing with them. But if you do have to share them, or if you do have to, I guess, seek permission, especially if there's like a financial need involved to pay for those sessions, I think the most important thing to explain to parents is to say this, a very similar dialogue as what I said before, is that this is a serious issue. This is impacting me on a serious level. I am not feeling well in myself. I'm not able to do, you know, insert XYZ activities as well as I used to. And I know that this will get me to a place where I can talk to somebody and share my, you know, share how I feel, share how I'm doing, and they will help support me in getting back on my feet or getting back to that level of, you know, livability that I have before. Because mental illnesses don't necessarily become illnesses until they've actually impacted your life, like your day-to-day, your activities of daily living. Once you feel that's been impacted, you probably fit the criteria for that mental illness. So it's not just about having certain traits. It's about having some, you know, a cluster of traits, plus it impacts your life in a negative way. So explaining to them that this is something that you need in order to get back on that, you know, back to that level of activities of daily living that you had before. And explaining to them, I guess you could even say, I found a Muslim therapist. I don't know if that would give you brownie points. And you can give them, I think there's some videos by the only imam that I think I know in the States is Imam Muhammad Sulaiman. I don't know if you guys know him. He talks a lot about mental health. So I think giving them something to level with them and say, hey, look, this imam, you know, share with them a lecture or share with them a podcast, because he does podcasts. He does, like, he's on Twitter. So like, share with them something that he shared about mental health and explain to them, look, this is an imam. He has said these things about seeking mental health support. And I think that it's not, you know, outside of our religion. And I'm not very educated about, unfortunately, as much about Islamic, you know, mental health support, but I know for a fact that there are things that you can derive from a hadith and stuff like that about mental health and about seeking mental health support that even the Prophet himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, would have required. So I think, like, honestly, if you need to do your digging, get your information and like come with them with a very good set of facts and information and defend yourself.
And I think, like in our, like with our parents, sometimes they might, I'm not sure if this is true, but it's because, like, you know, they worry about us so much. They don't want you to, you know, since they have like a, I guess like they don't think of mental health as something, I mean, like seeking therapy as something good. So they're worried about you and they might just like be trying to push off your feelings, maybe tell you that you're being dramatic or there's nothing or whatever. But do you feel like, if you keep insisting and keep talking to your family members, even if they don't say yes from the beginning, even if you show them all these resources, that there's hope that they'll be okay with it?
I mean, I guess if they don't respond well after you have given that information, first of all, I'm sorry. That's really hard. And I guess my question is, you know, for both of them, for the child and for the parent, for the child, why do your parents have to know? What is the limiting factor here? So if they do, they have to know that you're going to go to therapy every couple weeks, every week for the next little while. Is it a financial burden? If that's the case, then I understand. Like, if you do need support in financing that, totally understand. If there isn't a need for them to know, I guess, what is, you know, is it guilt? Is it feeling shame that you should tell them? What is it going on there? And I would want to touch on that first. And for the parent, I'd want to know, I guess, what are their fears? Are they afraid that you're going to communicate something to them that they're not happy with? Like, are they afraid of you sharing things with the therapist that they don't want you to share? Or are they just worried, maybe perhaps they feel like they're inadequate, that they haven't done a good enough job, that, you know, you should be happy, I want you to be happy, and they feel their own inadequacies and project them onto their children, and say, you know, I've done all these things, you should be happy, right? Like, our parents say that all the time, like, you should be so happy with how much I've taken care of you and you have everything you need. And it's not about that. So I think it's understanding from your parents' perspective and saying to them, like, I love you. You have done everything you can in your, within your means, within what you know, to help me and support me being a good, valuable member of society. But it's more than that right now. And I need a little bit of extra support. And I don't want to burden you with it. I don't want it to be on your shoulders. I want somebody to help support me, because I know that we all need our own support sometimes. And it's not going to be necessarily like a fruitful conversation if it's just me within my family. I need somebody else to come in and help me try to figure out what, you know, what's going on. So I guess try to empathize with them. Like, what is it that they're feeling? Maybe they feel super inadequate that you need somebody to talk to. And maybe you also feel guilt for not, for telling them, even though you probably don't have to tell them. You really don't, especially if you're an adult. If you're over 18, over 21, whatever it is in the States, I don't know. If you're an adult in your area, you might live with your parents, but, like, we'll talk about this in the boundaries podcast, but you don't have to tell your parents every single thing that you're doing. You don't have to tell your parents, especially if it's for your mental health and well-being, and you know that you're going to be met with resistance. You are your own adult. Living in your parents' house does not grant them access to everything that you are and everything that you do.
Yeah, and Nana, I really love what you said about boundaries. And for everyone listening, we will be recording an episode about setting boundaries with Nahla as well, so stay tuned for that after the Taboo series. But I really loved how you talked about how even in your own personal experience, you were in your own house and you didn't, you know, you didn't say just because, like, you didn't feel the need to. And I, our cultures perpetuate this idea that you have to say everything. If you're hiding something, it must be bad. Like, there's just this, you know, inevitable thing to anything you're hiding. It must be something horrible. And I just really love how you kind of gave that example. And thank you so much for being willing to share that with us. I really loved how you gave that, because it just demonstrates, like, the importance of setting boundaries, which I don't want to get into much in this episode, but thank you so much for saying that. And I was recently reading an article about a teenage boy who lived in the U.S. I think it was in Minnesota, and he had been bullied. He was Muslim, and he had been bullied at school, and he had, you know, a variety of mental health issues, and unfortunately he ended up committing suicide after. And his parents are suing the school district for not doing anything and for allowing this kind of behavior to proceed and for not addressing his, you know, health concerns within the school and for not keeping him safe in the school. And, you know, these kind of stories, I feel like, unfortunately, are just never even talked about. And they're very much like brushed under the rug or viewed as like something that could never happen to anyone. And, you know, I just think, like you were saying, like, for maybe anxiety or something that's more common, we talk about it. But for something like suicide, you know, something so serious and something so triggering for many people, we often don't talk about it. So how should someone deal with having suicidal thoughts, or when they know that a friend is having suicidal thoughts, especially with this idea that Muslims kind of communicate that, you know, suicide is haram, you'll go to hell for it and all this stuff. So how do we kind of help someone through that situation without making them feel like they're a terrible person?
I did not know that story. That's really intense. I guess the first question that came to my mind when you said it is how was he treated at home? Before you blame the school, it's like, what was going on at home, and how were things between him and his parents? And unfortunately, that's a very sad situation. Unfortunately, it does happen. It happens. For somebody who's having, first of all, to the person who's having those thoughts. So in my area, I know there are at least 10 helplines that you can access 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And there is actually even a Muslim helpline called Nasiha here in my area. I don't know if you guys have it too. So please start there. the reason I say start there is because if you don't have a counselor, psychologist, psychotherapist, psychiatrist, somebody in your world, in your circle that you follow up with regularly, that you can just like call their secretary and be like, I need to talk to them ASAP. I have, you know, suicidal thoughts, or you can't call them and ask them for your, you know, you don't have a safety plan in place, or you don't have like basically a plan for what you're going to do when you have those thoughts, go to the helpline, because in that moment they are trained. They're trained individuals to sit with you, talk with you, reduce those feelings that you have at that moment, and get you to a point where you can make a rational next step decision. So you'll have somebody that can support you in that moment that isn't going to necessarily make it worse. Perhaps sometimes we try to help, but we make it worse. And you know, you don't have to go to your family members and run the risk of the guilt associated with those feelings, like you mentioned, like they're, you know, they're quote unquote haram. So number one, I would say helplines. Number two, if you already know of a mental health resource center in your community or a hospital, also call them. So if you don't have the helplines, call the mental health community centers or the hospitals. I say the centers first, because they actually have like dispatch people that can come to you right away rather than you having to try to figure out your way to the hospital. So I wish I kind of knew your area a little bit better to share that information, but if we'd like Google search, we can get a couple numbers on like on the podcast to tell them to call this number, or to, you know, there's like usually a day phone number, a night phone number, whatever it is. So in those acute moments of suicidal thoughts, definitely start there. To follow up from that afterwards, always follow up with like somebody. So usually when you are connected with a mental health center or a hospital, you end up getting somebody that's like an advocate for you. So they'll be like your case manager. So you'll have somebody that will connect you with what resources they find suitable for you based on their assessment. And then you can accept them or you can decline them. It's, you know, you're autonomous, you can control your health, but you'll have that case manager to call or message or whatever it is when you do have, you know, recurring thoughts, or you feel like that's going to start happening again, because they can, you know, often patients can know, oh my gosh, I'm going to feel it soon. This is going to happen. They know their triggers. So you'll have somebody to talk to. And when it's your friend, it's the same idea, but a little bit different, because you also do have an obligation as somebody who loves and cares for this person to advocate for them. So if they're not willing, or if they're not ready, or if they're afraid to mention this to anyone else, let's say you're the only person that knows, I would say, you know, speaking to them and advocating for them to do the same things that I just mentioned. So telling them you do love them, you do care for them, and you do want to be there for them, but within your capacity and your means, and that you know that they deserve more care, they deserve better care, they deserve people who are trained to help them, who can support them long term. While you're there, you're going to be there along the way, like you're going to be there for them, but there's people out there that are going to be better at being able to help them, support them, and get them into a better place. So trying to advocate for them to use those phone numbers, go to the health centers, get somebody to talk to you more regularly, a counselor or anything of the type. But in those acute moments, it's really hard to talk down those thoughts, but I'm actually going through it right now. There's like a training program for these helplines where they go through it with you. So I haven't learned them all yet, but it's like a lot of mindfulness techniques, a lot of like name three things you hear, name three things you feel, name three things you see, and just basically grounding them back into their environment, into their world. Because often they'll dissociate and then have those thoughts. So you can just bring them back into that center. So in an acute moment, I think if you know your friend is having those thoughts, even if you just quickly search like how to de-escalate, like, you know, a suicidal thought, or how to bring that grounding techniques or meditation techniques, you can help them and be with them in those moments. And then wait until they've come back to, you know, their normal self and talk to them about further help.
Also, I was kind of like wondering too, like with your, sorry, yes, to like deviate a little bit, but when, you know, you have, oftentimes I feel like in the Muslim community, one of the first people that someone may go to who's experiencing like a mental health crisis, or, you know, any of the things that we've talked about or not, they go to their friends, because, you know, it's stigmatized with their parents or with their community members or in their masjids or community centers or whatever. And, you know, as the friend who's being like told these kinds of things, how can someone kind of prevent, like, you know, their own mental health like deteriorating, or how can they like take care of their own mental health when they have their friends or their community members or younger people in their community coming to them and telling them that they're having these struggles? How do you kind of take care of yourself in that moment too,
so that you can not only take care of other people, but, you know, care for yourself as well?
That's a really important question. I guess that from my own experiences, I can speak on that. I've been able to work, luckily, in mental health units, and I've been able to have, you know, really amazing friends that have been there for me and that I've been there for them. And I've experienced both worlds where I recognize that, in fact, when it's in a professional setting and you're working or volunteering, something like that, you end up getting a lot more support because it's already sort of predicted. It's going to happen. You can be the most empathetic human being, the most, you know, the most giving person, and still feel drained or still feel like, oh my, I'm not doing well after I just heard that or experienced that or witnessed that. Or you feel drained after supporting people. When it's happening in your personal life with your friends is where I notice that it can be the most draining, because that's where we don't draw those boundaries as well. And that's where we can fall into the trap of giving and giving and giving. And I'll speak from my experience. So I've, in the last few months, have been going through quite a difficult time. It's okay. I'm in a better place and I'm getting through that. But throughout that time as well, my friends have all been going through a really difficult time. So I'm sure we can all relate that pretty much everybody is going through a hard time. And I always find myself as an empathetic person and someone who does love to support people. I love to be there for them. I want to be that friend that, I feel like when I give more, I feel better. But that, you know, that immediate hit of like me feeling better, like, oh, I hear them say thank you, or I see them and they're already immediately feeling better. That feeling wears off so quickly, and I'm happy for them. It doesn't mean that I'm not happy and I'm not, you know, genuinely wanting them to be in a better place. It's that I go home and I'm like, whoa, I don't know why I feel so unwell right now. I feel so drained. I just want to sleep for like 2 days. Like, it can impact you for a long time and you don't even realize it in the moment. You realize it after. And then the next day you get up again and you go out with your friends and you're there supporting them, and you go through another, you know, very draining session where you're like there for them. And look, it's not a bad thing to be a supportive person and to be empathetic and loving towards your friends, but it is a bad thing when you don't listen to that inner voice, like that person that, you know, your body signaling you that you're reaching a limit. You can love somebody so much and be there for them so much, but still recognize that I'm about to hit a limit right now, and I don't want to drain myself because I can't help them anymore if I myself am going to be drained, you know, on a regular basis. So listen to that signal in your body when you're getting that, and you'll recognize it more and more. Once you start putting in boundaries, you'll be like, oh, I'm getting it. I need to stop. I've hit a limit. And gently tell your friend, I'm so sorry that I don't think I can be the most supportive person right now, but I can sit with you in what you're feeling. I can be here for you physically. I can sit with these emotions with you, but I don't think I can give as much right now. And they should understand, ideally, you know, the good friends, they should usually understand. So definitely communicate it gently, but I think the most difficult thing is first recognizing when you're reaching the limit, but listen to your body. Like, it'll tell you. We just suppress it. We just don't listen to our bodies. We don't prioritize ourselves in those moments. We're really focused on that person. But once we start creating more and more boundaries and loving ourselves more, respecting our limits more, I know from experience, I'm so much better at it now. I can realize my personal limit. I can remove myself from the situation, or you can gently say, I don't know if I can offer any more support right now. I don't think I'm the best person, but I can be with you in this moment.
As you said, like, they're your good friends. They're going to understand, you know, because, like, obviously you want to be there for them, but you also want to be there for yourself. So I think it's important to realize that if your friends also support you, that they'll understand where your limit is.
Yeah. And I don't know if your question was also about, like, the repercussions of having, you know, heard really traumatic things or seen really traumatic things as well. To move, like, on from that, if it's not necessarily in the moment, if it's afterwards, for you to be able to manage those thoughts and emotions, take it as seriously as needing mental health help, because you do need somebody to talk to, what's the word when you debriefing with them, even if you don't have to share details or, you know, share someone's private information. Definitely don't do that. But if you want to talk about something, having that debrief session with somebody else is also really important. And therapy is really good for that. So if you do have someone in your life that you feel like you've heard information or you've talked about things that are traumatic to you, it's not a bad thing to find someone that you trust to debrief with them and say, hey, look, can I talk to you about this? I need a little bit of advice or some clarity, or I just need to get it off my chest, or finding an external support person to talk to when you're feeling those overwhelming thoughts about something you've heard or learned.
But so So like kind of going on along the same lines that we were talking about before, like if someone does have access to therapy or counseling, what things should they consider as like young Muslims going into therapy? Is it important for us to be like very adamant about finding a therapist or counselor that has the same background as us or has the same religion as us? Or do you think like that's super important, or is it a myth that someone who doesn't share the same background or religion as us won't understand mm-hmm. us, and then it won't be beneficial? A lot of like places, there's not that many Muslim therapists, so maybe a lot of young Muslims, if they don't have Muslim therapists, they might just, you know, think it's not going to be worth it and not even like
yeah that was the first thing I was going to say, is like there's probably not an abundance of Muslim therapists in all of our communities. Like in some communities there might be, but not everywhere, so it's not a consistent thing that you'll be able to access. I guess that for every single person, it's going to be different. You know, I have friends that when I started going to therapy, I would talk to them about it, or, you know, just share some things I've learned. And they would ask me about who my therapist is. And I kind of just like, I didn't want to share her name, but I did share like a little bit of details about her. And they were like, oh, so you have a Muslim therapist. And I was like, honestly, it didn't really factor into my decision of finding a Muslim therapist. Like I just searched for one and I ended up going with one that is Muslim. So for me, it wasn't a huge priority to find one. But in the end, after going through therapy with her, it was invaluable. Like for some reason, subhanAllah, I don't know how it happened, but it was actually the greatest thing. Like I found that she really understood my feelings, and, you know, a lot of the shame and guilt that we put onto ourselves as Muslim women, like she really got it and she could really support me through that. So it turned out to be beneficial for me, despite the fact that I wasn't even looking for it. Whereas my friend who heard that was like, oh, I wouldn't want a Muslim therapist. She just doesn't, she wouldn't want to see one. For her, that could be associated with feeling judgment from them for certain things that she might share and things like that. So within your community, if there are Muslim therapists, first of all, you're lucky. Like, God bless, that's amazing. Second of all, think about the community you live in and who they are. If you feel safe sharing with them, even if you know legally they can't talk to anyone about it, we know that, but if you feel that any sense of judgment might come from that person, or if you know them personally, or they know your family, or, you know, communities can be quite small and tight-knit, so they factor that in as well, that if you feel like you won't open up to them and be as comfortable, you're wasting your time. You know, therapy should be the most comfortable, safe space that you get into, you know, not right away, not immediately, but as you go through it, it becomes your safe space. So factoring in your community, who they are, if you know them personally or your family does. And some people do know their therapist, you know, personally, because within that community, it's so small, there are only so few, and it works out. So thinking about that individually for you. When it comes to our struggles at the moment, like, you know, with Islam and the way that things are sort of, I guess, assumed about us and how we behave and how we should be, I think if you feel like your struggles are particularly unique and you're like, you know what, I don't know if a American or Canadian, you know, therapist will be able to understand my family dynamics, my relationship dynamics, my limitations, you know, like the certain feelings about sex, about sexuality, about engaging in particular, I guess, behaviors, smoking, marijuana, other drugs, if they're not going to understand where you come from with it, from your unique background, and you think that a Muslim individual will allow that insight for you, definitely go for that. If you feel like it'll turn out to be the opposite and you'd rather go to somebody who won't be that person for you, who will be able to listen to you completely objectively and empathize with that, even if they don't personally relate to it, then go for that. But from my knowledge and experience, therapists come from a lot of different backgrounds. And even within their own family, if they are, you know, a white American person, if their family could be more strict than the Muslim family you come from. You know, they could have grown up with way stricter values. They could have never done any of the things I just mentioned, you know, any sexual activity prior to marriage, any drug use, any alcohol. There are a lot of different people on this earth. So we can stereotype them as much as they stereotype us. So I think go into it with an open mind. And try to call a few different therapists, which is what I did. And when I first, because you do like a free first consultation just to sort of talk about what you want to do with them and what you want to do with therapy, I guess. So talk about what you would like and ask them the questions. Like, I really want to talk about this, but I come from this particular background. Do you think that you can support that unique experience that I've been through? And I guess ask those questions that really matter to you to them and pick the one that you feel like will best suit what your journey, like what you want to do with therapy.
I think that's like really important because when you were talking about it, I always thought in my head, like, if I ever wanted to seek help or go to therapy, that I would always go to a Muslim therapist just because I felt like maybe a non-Muslim one mm-hmm. would understand me. But you were saying, like, if you are in a tight-knit community, our community is tight-knit. I don't know any therapists here, but if there were therapists in, like, Greenville that were Muslim, I don't know if I would feel comfortable going to them just because I know, like, how our community works and how, even if it is confidential, I don't know if I could trust 100% that, you know, what I talk about would get out, you know? And, like, also for... like for me, when I thought about it, like I would only go to a Muslim one is because like when I was at the crisis line, every time we answered a call, there was a lot of judgment in the room, you know? And I don't think, you know, that's supposed to happen, but I was just like, if I would ever call here, they wouldn't be able to understand what I'm talking about. And I think it's because, you know, it is a volunteer line and you can't really, I guess, control what happens in there. So I would like rather call, let's say like Nasir mm-hmm. or somewhere that, are Muslims that would understand what's going on, because there's a lot of like, although we're not supposed to assume what that person's going through as volunteers, you know, that happens because you aren't like trained for a really long time and, you know, things of that sort. Like they're in Greenville, at least the people that answered the crisis line, none of them were certified mental mm-hmm. health professionals. So I felt like it was, that was something in the back of my head all the time. I was like, you know, if I ever have to go through something and let's say I don't feel comfortable talking to those around me, or, you know, I don't want to burden those around me, I couldn't pick up the phone and call this crisis line because, you know, they would just maybe play it as, you know, I don't understand what you're going through, or like, what is this? Like, just talk to you. Or like, let's say a lot of the things that they talked about within the family, it was just like, just openly talk to your mother. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in our community, sometimes doing that is not, it's not the best option. So I don't know. That's like a lot of what I was thinking about while you were,
That's like, I totally understand. Like it's, every community is going to be different. And the only reason I actually can understand that experience is because I've worked in an area that is a rural area and I've heard it from patients directly, like saying, I don't want to see that person. I actually know them. And it never hit me. It never occurred to me because I've grown up in a city my whole life. So we can definitely be very privileged as well with what mental health access we have when we live in certain communities. So I totally respect that, like why you would probably not trust somebody that you know in your own community and would rather go to someone you don't know.
And along those lines, like, let's say you still feel more comfortable going to a Muslim therapist, but the ones in your area, let's say you don't have any Muslim therapists in your area, or the ones in your area, you just don't feel comfortable talking to them. Is it an option to do, let's say, online therapy with someone that doesn't live in your area?
Definitely. I would say definitely do a little bit of research where you live or, and, you know, in your surrounding areas. But for me, I haven't had a single in-person session with my therapist. And we decided that early on. Like she said, are you comfortable with that? I was like, yes, I don't want to go into any sort of clinical or hospital site right now, unless I have to, because of COVID. So if you feel comfortable doing things online, if you can sort of have a little bit like an hour to yourself in your house, in your room or something to just have that privacy for an hour, definitely do it. If that's completely impossible, then yes, you'd have to probably do it online to go in, in person, sorry, to go into an in-person clinic. But yeah, I don't actually know where she practices. I think she practices somewhere in the Greater Toronto Area. So she's not really nearby. So yeah, I think finding a therapist that's outside of your area, especially in COVID, all of them, I think every single therapist is offering things online, and most of them are doing it strictly online, except for their high-risk patients. So I think definitely go online and have a search. But I also wanted to mention there is a difference between psychologists and psychotherapists. So I don't know if all the viewers and like listeners, sorry, will know the difference. So Google that as well and try to figure out what it is that you're trying to get from therapy and read what a psychologist can offer and what psychotherapy can offer. Psychiatry is completely different. That's, you know, a medical specialty where there are medications involved and things like that. And it's a little bit, it's a lot less talk therapy. But if you need the talk therapy, those are your options. And I'd urge you to look at those options in your area and also ask them if they do online or in person and which one would better suit you. And even if they're far away and you have a Muslim one that you found in your state but completely in a different city and you'd prefer to see them, I don't see why not. I don't see why they couldn't take you on.
Yeah, I think that's so important too, is like making those distinctions. And thank you for like helping to like educate everyone and like help us all like, you know, really find out exactly what we need. And I think it's just so important to, you know, share our experiences, because I feel like so much for me of like my mental health, like concerns, like where it's come from, it's like always feeling like I have to explain myself or like I have to explain my identity and who I am to the people and to the society mm-hmm. around me. And I think that when you were talking about having a Muslim therapist and how invaluable it was, I think that, again, it, like you were saying, it differs for everyone. Like for some people, it doesn't matter. But like just not having to explain yourself for once and not mm-hmm. having to validate why you do something or why you don't do something is like so important, I think, to just making me personally like feel at peace. So I really appreciate that advice. And I think that, like you and Rand were mentioning, in the virtual era and as we become more comfortable with things being virtual, access to Muslim therapists or therapists who you feel like you can personally connect with mm-hmm. will hopefully be something that only increases in the coming years as we become more comfortable and we develop technology to, you know, connect clinical settings right into like people's houses.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's probably becoming easier to access the type of psychology or psychotherapy that you want and even the individual that you want. So that's pretty empowering now. There's one silver lining of COVID, and it makes, I think, healthcare a little bit actually easier, which is ironic, but yeah.
But yeah, thank you so much for sharing all of this. Like, I honestly learned so much. And, you know, I feel like so inspired to kind of continue these conversations in our community. And I hope that this episode inspires people who live here, or who don't live here, live anywhere, to have these conversations with their family members and with their communities to encourage everyone to become more open-minded and to destigmatize mental health in the coming years. So thank you so much for sharing.
No worries. I was a pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
That's all that we have for you guys today. So we hope that you guys enjoyed this episode and really benefited from it, because I really felt like I did. And just like a reminder, you guys can all follow Dr. Nahla on Instagram at I'm Dr. Nahla. And also she posts really cool TikToks and her username is at Dr. Nahla as well. And as always, remember to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and share and discuss this episode with your family and friends. And especially if you are looking to seek therapy and, you know, you want to start having that conversation with your parents.
And remember to give us any feedback about this episode by filling out the anonymous Survey Monkey on our Instagram, where you can anonymously leave feedback about our Taboo series for us. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, DM us on social media, or email us at realtalkrealmuslims@gmail.com.
That's Real Talk Real Muslims for you.
Bye.